tank was 2.6, and the pressure in the oxidizer tank was 18.8. Holder suggested shutting down the power to the missile. The socket might have struck an electrical panel and started a fire. But even if it hadn't, having power in the silo might somehow give off a spark that would ignite the fuel vapor. Although the suggestion felt like grasping at straws, Holder thought it was something they could actually do instead of just sitting there. A checklist was composed with help from the Missile Potential Hazard Team. Everyone agreed that Circuit Breaker 13, which supplied power to the PTPMU, should be left on so that tank pressure readings could still be obtained. As Holder read the first sentence of the checklist and prepared to turn off circuit breakers, a light on the commander's console indicated that the sprays had stopped. The hard water tank in the silo had run out of water. It was supposed to be refilled automatically by the soft water tank topside. But the faulty switch on the hard water tank that Holder and Fuller noticed during the morning inspection had prompted someone, months or even years earlier, to close the pipe linking the two tanks. About 100,000 gallons of water had sprayed into the silo, and an additional 100,000 were still available topside. The crew, however, had no way of getting that extra water. The indicator said the pump in the silo was still pumping, and yet nothing was coming out of it. Childers tried to turn off the pump, concerned that its electric motor might produce a spark. He kept pushing the button, but the pump wouldn't stop. At about 8:05, the launch duct temp high warning light flashed red. The temperature in the silo had reached 80 degrees, and without the sprays of cold water, it would keep climbing. The pressure in the fuel tank was down to 0.4 psi. The pressure in the oxidizer tank was 19.5 and rising fast. Captain Mazzaro asked for permission to evacuate the control center. Permission was denied. The Missile Potential Hazard Team in Little Rock had a plan. The refcos that Powell and Plum had worn still held about 40 minutes of air. The suits in the blast lock hadn't been used. They were good for at least an hour. According to Little Rock's plan, the PTS crew would retrieve the refcos from the blast lock, put them on, check the MSA, and report the vapor levels in the equipment area of the silo. If the levels were low enough, the men would proceed to the equipment area and turn on the purge fan. That might clear some of the fuel vapors out of the silo. It was worth a try. Fuller, Lester, and Powell stood beside Blast Door 8. Powell kept his hand on the button. He unlocked the door, and Lester slowly cracked it open. The blast lock was filled with a white, hazy mist that smelled like fuel and smoke. Lester slammed the door, and Powell locked it. The refcos in the blast lock were now useless, contaminated, and the control center didn't have enough suits for the job. The safety rules required at least two people with refcos as backup whenever a team went Category 1. The PTS crew topside had four refcos on their truck, but nobody could reach them on the radio. It was 8:20. The pressure in the fuel tank was minus 0.4 psi. At least that's what the gauge said. The PTPMU hadn't been calibrated for negative readings, and the actual pressure could have been even lower. The pressure in the oxidizer tank had risen to 23.4. The PTS team chief, Heinemann, asked if they could be evacuated. Childers and Holder finished shutting off the power to the missile, and at the direction of the command post, turned off the air conditioning in the silo, too. Although the air conditioner cooled the silo, it could also produce a spark and ignite the fuel. Childers didn't want to evacuate, and neither did Holder. They wanted to stay put. They were good friends, discussed the issue quietly, and agreed about what should be done. Mazzaro's wife and Fuller's wife were pregnant. Mazzaro's was due to have the baby any day. "We ought to let the other guys leave," Childers and Holder decided. "We'll stay here and ride this thing out." They volunteered to remain in the control center. It was important for someone to stay there. the two could monitor the PTPMU, keep an eye on the hazard lights, or even open the silo door. They felt confident that the blast doors would hold. "If the missile blows," Holder said, "I think we'll be okay." The strength of a blast wave is measured by the overpressure it produces, the amount of air pressure greater than that found at sea level, measured in pounds per square inch. An overpressure of 0.5 psi shatters windows. An overpressure of 2 psi destroys wooden homes, and an overpressure of 8 psi knocks down brick walls. The Titan II silo door was designed to withstand a nuclear detonation with an overpressure of 300 psi. The underground blast doors were even stronger. They were supposed to protect the crew not only from a nuclear detonation outside, but also from a missile explosion within the silo. The enormous doors on both sides of the blast lock, theoretically, would survive an overpressure of 1,130 psi. At 8:30, about 2 hours after the accident, the wing commander ordered everyone to evacuate the complex. The pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank had fallen to minus 0.7 psi. The safety of the crew could not be guaranteed. The missile could explode at any moment. While Mazzaro and Childers stuffed top-secret documents into the floor safe, Holder and Fuller put on gas masks and went downstairs to Level 3 of the control center to open the emergency escape hatch. It wasn't easy. The hatch was a metal dome attached to the wall by thick screws. The men took turns unscrewing them with a large ratchet. The hatch opened a little more with each twist of the ratchet. Holder took off his gas mask. He was out of breath and didn't think the mask was necessary. Yet. He'd opened the escape hatch a few times during inspections, but he'd never been inside the narrow 10-foot tunnel beyond it. The tunnel led to a steel ladder embedded in the concrete wall of an air shaft that traveled about 50 feet upward to the surface. Childers couldn't close the door to the safe. There were too many documents crammed inside it. The command post told him not to worry about them, to leave the door open. But he felt uncomfortable leaving it that way. Although the launch keys and the cookies were securely locked in a different safe, the emergency war order checklists were among these documents. Someone who got hold of them would learn a great deal about how to issue a launch order and how to countermand one. The issue soon became moot. The safe wouldn't close. The crew had to evacuate, and nobody else was likely to be entering the control center soon. Once the escape hatch was open, the PTS team went down to Level 3 wearing gas masks. The missile combat crew members grabbed their handguns and put on their holsters. Before departing from the control center, they took the phone off the hook so that officers on the line at Little Rock could hear if any klaxons, alarms, or portable vapor detectors went off. And the crew switched the diesel generator to manual. That way the generator wouldn't automatically turn on if power to the entire complex was later shut off, an option being considered. Motors and pumps in the equipment areas of the silo were still running, because the circuit breakers to shut them off were inside the silo. Ideally, the crew wouldn't have left anything running that might cause a spark, but they'd done the best they could. They put on their gas masks and hurried downstairs. Fuller entered the hatch first, carrying a flashlight. It was pitch black in the narrow tunnel as he crawled toward the air shaft on his hands and knees. The PTS team and Serrano went next. Childers told them to look after the trainee. "Put him in the middle of you guys," Childers said, "because I'm not going to have him hurt." Holder followed them into the tunnel. He'd fought hard against evacuating the place, but now that it was time to go, he couldn't wait to get the hell out. Upstairs in the control center, the intruder alarm went off. Fuller must have reached the surface and pushed open the grate, interrupting the radar beams aimed at the air shaft. The TIPSI unit had detected the movement and activated the alarm, as though someone was trying to get into the control center, not out of it. Childers went through the hatch, leaving Captain Mazzaro to go last. The tunnel was dank and dark, like a drainage pipe, and he had to crawl through a pool of rusty water to the air shaft. Childers was terrified. The rungs of the ladder were on the far side of the shaft. You had to reach across to grab them, and it was incredibly dark. Childers was breathing hard in the gas mask as he climbed and couldn't see the ladder. He raised a hand and felt above his head for each rung, anxious to move as fast as possible, afraid of slipping and falling to the bottom of the shaft. The control center had felt safe. Now they really were vulnerable and unprotected. At the top of the ladder, Holder and Fuller pulled him from the air shaft onto the gravel. The three waited for Mazzara, lifted him out, and started to run. The wind seemed to be blowing to the east, carrying the white cloud from the exhaust vents toward the entry gate, so the men headed west. The PTS crew had already found the breakaway section of the fence, removed the quick-release pins, and pushed it down. Mazzara, Childers, Fuller, and Holder followed them through the gap in the fence, trying to circle the site and reach the front gate without passing through the cloud. The masks would protect their lungs, but fuel vapor could be readily absorbed through their skin. The crew made it about three-quarters of the way around the fence before the wind changed direction, blowing the white mist right toward them. "You've got to be kidding me," Holder thought, ready to be miles away from this place. When Sergeant Thomas A. Brocksmith arrived at the access road to the complex, he noticed that some law enforcement officers and reporters were already there. He introduced himself to the Van Buren County Sheriff. Brocksmith was the on-scene supervisor, responsible for Air Force security at the site. The sheriff asked what was going on. "The only information we have," Brocksmith replied, "is that there's a possible hazard on the complex, but there's no need for an evacuation at this point." About 20 minutes later, Brocksmith was ordered by the command post to drive toward the complex. He put on a gas mask, guided his pickup truck down the access road, and could see that something was seriously wrong. Gray smoke was billowing about 50 feet into the air and drifting over the entry gate. He parked the truck in the clear zone surrounding the fence. The complex was empty, quiet, and still. He looked around for anything out of the ordinary. Aside from the smoke, nothing about the complex seemed unusual. And then someone pounded hard on the passenger door of his truck, yelling, "Get out of here! Get out of here!" The noise scared Brocksmith, who looked at the door and saw 10 men in the dark wearing gas masks and Air Force uniforms. Somehow, they all crowded into the pickup, and he drove it out of there fast. In the abandoned control center, the hazard lights flashed, the intruder alarm rang, the escape hatch hung wide open, and water slowly dripped from the tunnel onto the concrete floor. Part 2. Machinery of Control. The best, the biggest, and the most. Hamilton Holt's dream of world peace finally seemed within reach. For decades he'd campaigned with one civic group after another, trying to end the perpetual conflict between nations, races, and religions. A graduate of Yale from a wealthy family, he'd worked closely with Andrew Carnegie at the New York Peace Society before the First World War. Holt championed the American Peace Society, the World Peace Foundation, the League to Enforce Peace, the League of Nations, the Conciliation Internationale, and the American Society of International Law. He was also a founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He edited a reform newspaper, ran for the U.S. Senate in 1924, lost by a wide margin, became the president of Rollins College the following year, and created a unique educational system there. Lectures were eliminated, and faculty members were hired by the students. College life didn't end his work on behalf of disarmament. During the 1930s, Holt erected a peace monument on the Rollins campus in Winter Park, Florida. The monument was a German artillery shell from the First World War set atop a stone plinth. The inscription began, "Pause, passerby, and hang your head in shame." In the spring of 1946, Holt hosted a conference on world government at Rollins. An idea that had long been dismissed as impractical and naive was now widely considered essential. Much of Europe, Russia, China, and Japan lay in ruins. About 50 million people had been killed during the recent war. The United States had been spared the destruction of its cities, and at first, the stunning news of the atomic bomb inspired relief at the swift defeat of Japan, as well as pride in American know-how. And then the implications began to sink in. General Henry H. Happ Arnold, commander of the United States Army Air Forces, warned the public that nuclear weapons, destructive beyond the wildest nightmares of the imagination, might someday be mounted on missiles, guided by radar, and aimed at American cities. Such an attack, once launched, would be impossible to stop. Despite having emerged from the conflict with unprecedented economic and military power, the United States suddenly felt more vulnerable than at any other time in its history. Seldom, if ever, has a war ended leaving the victors with such a sense of uncertainty and fear, CBS correspondent Edward R. Murrow noted, with such a realization that the future is obscure and that survival is not assured. Hamilton Holt had attended the San Francisco conference that created the United Nations, only weeks before the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the United Nations, Holt thought, wasn't really a world government. It was just another league of sovereign states, doomed to failure. The men who attended the conference at Rollins College felt the same way, and they were hardly a bunch of wild-eyed radicals. Among those who signed Holt's appeal to the peoples of the world were the president of the Standard Oil Company of Ohio, the chairman of the National Association of Manufacturers, three U.S. senators, one U.S. Supreme Court justice, a congressman, and Albert Einstein. The appeal called for the United Nations General Assembly to be transformed into the legislative branch of a world government. The General Assembly would be authorized to ban weapons of mass destruction, conduct inspections for such weapons, and use military force to enforce international law. "We believe these to be the minimum requirements," the appeal concluded, "of a world government capable of averting another war in the atomic era." Within weeks of the conference at Rollins, a collection of essays demanding international control of the atomic bomb became a New York Times bestseller. Its title was One World or None. And a few months later, an opinion poll found that 54% of the American people wanted the United Nations to become a world government with power to control the armed forces of all nations, including the United States. To a remarkable degree, even the U.S. military thought that the atomic bomb should be outlawed or placed under some form of international mandate. General Arnold was a contributor to One World or None. He'd been a leading proponent of strategic air power and supervised the American bombing of both Germany and Japan. The stress had taken its toll. Arnold suffered 4 heart attacks during the war, and his essay in One World or None was a final public statement before retirement. The appeal of nuclear weapons, he wrote, was simply a matter of economics. They had lowered the cost of destruction. They had made it too cheap and easy. An air raid that used to require 500 bombers now needed only one. Atomic bombs were terribly inexpensive compared to the price of rebuilding cities. The only conceivable defense against such weapons was a strategy of deterrence, a threat to use them promptly against an enemy in retaliation. A far better protection, Arnold concluded, lies in developing controls and safeguards that are strong enough to prevent their use on all sides. General Carl A. Spotts, who replaced Arnold as the Army Air Force's commander, was an outspoken supporter of world government. General George C. Kenney, the head of the recently created Strategic Air Command, spent most of his time working on the military staff of the United Nations. General Leslie Groves, the military director of the Manhattan Project, who was staunchly anti-communist and anti-Soviet, argued that the atomic bomb's very existence should make war unthinkable. He favored international control of nuclear weapons and tough punishments for nations that tried to make them. Without such a system, he saw only one alternative for the United States. If there are to be atomic bombs in the world, Groves argued, we must have the best, the biggest, and the most. At a cabinet meeting on September 21, 1945, members of the Truman administration had debated what to do with this powerful new weapon. The issue of international control was complicated by another question. Should the secrets of the atomic bomb be given to the Soviet Union? The Soviets were a wartime ally, lost more than 20 million people fighting the Nazis, and now possessed a military stronger than that of any other country except the United States. Canada and Great Britain had been invited to join the Manhattan Project, while the Soviets hadn't even been informed of its existence. In a memo to President Truman, Henry Stimson, the outgoing Secretary of War, worried that excluding the Soviets from the nuclear club would cause a secret armament race of a rather desperate character. He proposed a direct approach to the Soviet Union outside of any international forum that would share technical information about atomic energy as a first step toward outlawing the atomic bomb. Otherwise, the Soviets were likely to seek nuclear weapons on their own. Stimson thought that a U.S.-Soviet partnership could ensure a lasting peace. The only way you can make a man trustworthy, he told the president, is to trust him. Stimson's proposal was strongly opposed by Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal. We tried that once with Hitler, Forrestal said. There are no returns on appeasement. The meeting ended with the cabinet split on whether to share atomic secrets with the Soviet Union. A few weeks later, George F. Kennan, one of the State Department's Soviet experts, gave his opinion in a telegram from Moscow, where he was posted at the U.S. Embassy. There is nothing, I repeat, nothing, Kennan wrote, in the history of the Soviet regime which could justify us in assuming that the men who are now in power in Russia, or even those who have chances of assuming power within the foreseeable future, would hesitate for a moment to apply this atomic power against us if by doing so they thought that they might materially improve their own power position in the world. In the absence of formal guarantees or strict controls, it would be highly dangerous to give the Soviets any technical information about how to make an atomic bomb. President Truman reached the same conclusion, and the matter was soon dropped. The United States had good reason to distrust the Soviet Union. In 1939, the Soviet non-aggression pact with Germany was followed by the Nazi invasions of Poland, Belgium, and France. 2 years later, the Soviet neutrality pact with Japan was followed by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. During the war, the Soviet Union launched its own surprise attacks on Finland, the Baltic states, and Poland, and then executed tens of thousands of their citizens. After encouraging Japanese diplomats to believe it would mediate a peace agreement with the United States, the Soviet Union attacked and occupied Manchuria in the closing days of the war, causing the deaths of perhaps 300,000 Japanese soldiers and civilians. The ideology of the Soviet Union sought the overthrow of capitalist governments like that of the United States, and the Soviet leader, Joseph Stalin, was not only paranoid and megalomaniacal, but had already killed almost as many Russians as the Nazis had. The Soviets had reason to distrust the United States, too. It had intervened militarily in the Russian Civil War, using American troops to fight the Red Army until 1920. It had withheld diplomatic recognition of the Soviet Union until 1933. It had suffered vastly fewer casualties fighting the Nazis during the Second World War, and yet claimed an equal role in the administration of occupied Germany. The United States government had a long history of opposing almost every form of socialism and communism. Armed with nuclear weapons, it was now the greatest impediment to Soviet influence in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. President Truman decided that a domestic policy on atomic energy had to be adopted before the issue of international control could be addressed. The War Department favored the May-Johnson Bill, which would give the military a prominent role in atomic matters. The bill was also backed by J. Robert Oppenheimer, who'd become a celebrity since the end of the war, renowned as the father of the atomic bomb. But the legislation was vehemently opposed by most of the young scientists who'd worked on the Manhattan Project. For years, they had resented the strict, compartmentalized secrecy imposed by General Groves. Few of the Manhattan Project scientists had been allowed to know how the atomic bomb would be used. Many now regretted that both Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been destroyed. They considered themselves far more qualified than anyone in the Army to make decisions about atomic energy, and warned that passage of the May-Johnson Bill could turn the United States into a secretive, totalitarian state. Some still had an idealized vision of the Soviet Union and thought that the War Department's bill would endanger world peace. At the heart of the debate were fundamentally different views of who should control the atomic bomb: civilians or the military. Physicists representing groups like the Federation of American Scientists and the Association of Los Alamos Scientists traveled to Washington, D.C., testified before Congress, wrote editorials, gave impassioned speeches, and publicly attacked General Groves. An ambitious first-term senator from Connecticut, Brian McMahon, soon embraced their cause, asserting that the atomic bomb was too important to be left in the hands of a militaristic oligarchy. He was particularly upset that General Groves would not tell anyone in Congress how many atomic bombs the United States possessed or where they were kept, and that Groves refused to share that information with cabinet members, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or even the Secretary of War. President Truman backed the Army's insistence that details of the atomic stockpile should remain top secret for the sake of national security. But he sided with the young scientists on the issue of civilian control and threw his support to legislation sponsored by Senator McMahon. McMahon's bill, the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, was passed by Congress in a somewhat amended form and signed into law by the president. It created an Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, run by civilians and a Joint Committee on Atomic Energy that provided congressional oversight. Members of the military could serve on a liaison committee that advised the AEC, but they could not determine the agency's policies. The president was given the sole authority to decide how many atomic bombs the United States should have, when they should be handed over to the military, and whether they should be used against an enemy. One person now had the power to end the lives of millions with a single command. All of the laboratories, reactors, processing plants, fissile material, and atomic bomb parts belonging to the Manhattan Project were transferred to the AEC. Civilian control of the atomic bomb was now an American principle firmly established by law. But that did not prevent the military, almost immediately, from seeking to undermine it. "We are here to make a choice between the quick and the dead," Bernard Baruch told a gathering of United Nations delegates on June 14, 1946, at the Hunter College Gymnasium in the Bronx. "We must elect world peace or world destruction." Baruch was an elegant, silver-haired financier in his mid-70s who'd been asked by President Truman to offer a proposal for international control of the atomic bomb. The Baruch Plan called for the creation of a new agency affiliated with the UN that would own or control all atomic energy activities potentially dangerous to world security. The agency would have the power to inspect nuclear facilities throughout the world so that any attempt to make nuclear weapons could be discovered and severely punished. The new system of international control would be imposed in stages and would eventually outlaw the manufacture, possession, or use of atomic bombs. The United States was willing to hand over its winning weapons, Baruch said, but would require a guarantee of safety stronger than mere words. The selection of Bernard Baruch to help formulate the American plan had been controversial within the Truman administration. Many liberals criticized Baruch for being too old, too ignorant about atomic weaponry, and too suspicious of the Soviet Union. The Baruch plan was attacked by Oppenheimer, among others, for not being bold enough, for emphasizing inspections and punishments instead of cooperation with the Soviets. Oppenheimer favored a scheme that would share technical information about atomic energy and promote goodwill. On June 19th, the Soviet Union offered its own plan. Andrei Gromyko, the Soviet foreign minister, proposed that first the United States should destroy all of its nuclear weapons, and then an agreement should be reached on how to prevent other nations from obtaining them. The Soviet response confirmed liberal doubts about the Baruch plan and conservative doubts about the Soviet Union. During the summer of 1946, some form of international agreement to outlaw the atomic bomb still seemed within reach. Although the Soviets complained that the United States was trying to prolong its nuclear monopoly, America's defense policies were hardly those of an imperialist power seeking world domination. In fact, the United States was quickly dismantling its armed forces. The number of soldiers in the U.S. Army soon dropped from about 8 million to fewer than 1 million. The number of airplanes in the Army Air Forces fell from almost 80,000 to fewer than 25,000, and only one-fifth of those planes were thought ready for action. Ships and tanks were permanently scrapped, and the defense budget was cut by almost 90%. American servicemen were eager to come home after the war and resume their normal lives. When the pace of demobilization seemed too slow, they staged protest marches in occupied Germany. The American people expressed little desire to build an empire or maintain a strong military presence overseas. Although the War Department sought to acquire a wide range of foreign bases, the likelihood of any military challenge to the United States seemed remote. No major strategic threat or requirement now exists, in the opinion of our country's best strategists, Major General St. Clair Street, the deputy commander of SAC, said in July 1946. Nor will such a requirement exist for the next 3 to 5 years. At the very moment when hopes for world government, world peace, and international control of the atomic bomb reached their peak, the Cold War began. Without the common enemy of Nazi Germany, the alliance between the Soviet Union and the United States started to unravel. The Soviet Union's looting of Manchuria, its delay in removing troops from Iran, and its demand for Turkish territory along the Mediterranean coast unsettled the Truman administration. But the roots of the Cold War lay in Germany and Eastern Europe, where the Soviets hoped to create a buffer zone against future invasion. Ignoring promises of free elections and self-determination, the Soviet Union imposed a communist puppet government in Poland. George Kennan told the State Department that the Soviets were fanatically committed to destroying our traditional way of life. And Winston Churchill warned that an iron curtain had descended across Europe, along with the expansion of communist totalitarian rule. By March 1947, American relations with the Soviet Union had grown chilly. In a speech before Congress, President Truman offered economic aid to countries threatened by a system relying on terror and oppression, a controlled press and radio, fixed elections, and the suppression of personal freedoms. Although the speech never mentioned the Soviet Union by name, the target of the Truman Doctrine was obvious. The United States now vowed to contain Soviet power throughout the world. The divide between East and West in Europe widened a few months later when the Soviets prevented their allies from accepting U.S. aid through the Marshall Plan. In February 1948, the communist overthrow of Czechoslovakia's freely elected government shocked the American public. The Soviet-backed coup revived memories of the Nazi assault on the Czechs in 1938, the timidity of the European response, and the World War that soon followed. President Truman's tough words were not backed, however, by a military strategy that could defend Western Europe. During the early months of 1947, as Truman formulated his anti-communist doctrine, the Pentagon did not have a war plan for fighting the Soviet Union, and the rapid demobilization of the American military seemed to have given the Soviets a tremendous advantage on the ground. The U.S. Army had only one division stationed in Germany, along with 10 police regiments, for a total of perhaps 100,000 troops. The British Army had one division there as well. According to U.S. intelligence reports, the Soviet Army had about 100 divisions, with about 1.2 million troops capable of invading Western Europe, and could mobilize more than 150 additional divisions within a month. Instead of being outlawed by the UN, the atomic bomb soon became integral to American war plans for the defense of Europe. In June 1947, the Joint Chiefs of Staff sent a top-secret report, the evaluation of the atomic bomb as a military weapon, to President Truman. It contained the latest thinking on how nuclear weapons might be used in battle. The first post-war atomic tests, conducted the previous year at the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands, had demonstrated some of the weapon's limitations. Dropped on a fleet of empty Japanese and American warships, a Mark III implosion bomb like the one used at Nagasaki had missed its aiming point by almost half a mile, and failed to sink 83 of the 88 vessels. Ships at sea and bodies of troops are in general unlikely to be regarded as primary atomic bomb targets, the report concluded. The bomb is preeminently a weapon for use against human life and activities in large urban and industrial areas. It was a weapon useful most of all for killing and terrorizing civilians. The report suggested that a nuclear attack would stir up man's primordial fears and break the will of nations. The military significance of the atomic bomb was clear. It wouldn't be aimed at the military. Nuclear weapons would be used to destroy an enemy's morale, and some of the best targets were cities of a special sentimental significance. The Joint Chiefs did not welcome these conclusions, but assumed them to be true, the hard new reality of strategy in the nuclear age. If other countries obtained atomic bombs, they might be used in similar ways against the United States. The destructive power of these weapons was so great that the logic of waging a preventive war, of launching a surprise attack upon an enemy, might prove hard to resist. Like a shootout in the Old West, a nuclear war might be won by whoever fired first. A country with fewer atomic bombs than its adversary had an especially strong incentive to launch an attack out of the blue. And for that reason, among others, a number of high-ranking American officers argued that the United States should bomb the Soviet Union before it obtained any nuclear weapons. General Groves thought that approach would make sense, if we were ruthlessly realistic. General Orville Anderson, commander of the Air University, publicly endorsed an attack on the Soviets. "I don't advocate preventive war," Anderson told a reporter. "I advocate the shedding of illusions." He thought that Jesus Christ would approve of dropping atomic bombs on the Soviet Union. I think I could explain to him that I had saved civilization. Anderson was suspended for the remarks. Support for a first strike extended far beyond the upper ranks of the U.S. military. Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher and pacifist, imprisoned for his opposition to the First World War, urged the Western democracies to attack the Soviet Union before it got an atomic bomb. Russell acknowledged that a nuclear strike on the Soviets would be horrible, but anything is better than submission. Winston Churchill agreed, proposing that the Soviets be given an ultimatum: withdraw your troops from Germany or see your cities destroyed. Even Hamilton Holt, lover of peace, crusader for world government, lifelong advocate of settling disputes through mediation and diplomacy and mutual understanding, no longer believed that sort of approach would work. Nuclear weapons had changed everything, and the Soviet Union couldn't be trusted. Any nation that rejected UN control of atomic energy, Holt said, should be wiped off the face of the earth with atomic bombs. During the spring of 1948, the Joint Chiefs of Staff approved Half Moon, the first emergency war plan directed at the Soviet Union. It assumed that the Soviets would start a war in Europe, prompted by an accident or a misunderstanding. The conflict would begin with the United States losing a series of land battles. Greatly outnumbered and unable to hold Western Germany, the U.S. Army would have to stage a fighting retreat to seaports in France and Italy, then await evacuation by the U.S. Navy. The Red Army was expected to overrun Europe, the Middle East, and Korea. 15 days after the first shots were fired, the United States would launch a counterattack in the form of an atomic blitz. The plan originally called for 50 atomic bombs to be dropped on the Soviet Union. The number was later increased to 133, aimed at 70 Soviet cities. Leningrad was to be hit by 7 atomic bombs, Moscow by 8. The theory behind the counterattack was called the nation-killing concept. After an atomic blitz, Colonel Dale O. Smith explained, a nation would die just as surely as a man will die if a bullet pierces his heart. The defense of Great Britain was one of Half Moon's central aims, and much of the atomic blitz was to be launched from British air bases. But that would only encourage the Soviets, one Pentagon official warned, to begin the war with a devastating, annihilating attack on Great Britain. Denied access to British airfields, American planes would be forced to use bases in Egypt, India, Iceland, Greenland, Okinawa, or Alaska. The limited range of B-29 and B-50 bombers might require some American crews to fly one-way suicide missions. "It will be the cheapest thing we ever did," Major General Earl E. Partridge said. "Expend the crew, expend the bomb, expend the airplane all at once. Kiss them goodbye and let them go." President Truman was given a briefing on Half Moon and the atomic blitz in May 1948. He didn't like either of them. Truman told the Joint Chiefs to prepare a plan for defending Western Europe without using nuclear weapons. He still hoped that some kind of international agreement might outlaw them. The Joint Chiefs began to formulate ERASER, an emergency war plan that relied entirely on conventional forces. A month later, the Soviets cut rail, road, and water access to the western sectors of Berlin. Truman now faced a tough choice. Defying the blockade could bring war with the Soviet Union, but backing down and abandoning Berlin would risk the Soviet domination of Europe. The U.S. military governor of Germany, General Lucius D. Clay, decided to start an airlift of supplies into the city. Truman supported the airlift, while the Joint Chiefs of Staff expressed doubts, worried that the United States might not be able to handle a military confrontation with the Soviets. Amid the Berlin crisis, work on ERASER was halted. Truman issued a series of directives outlining how nuclear weapons should be used, and the atomic blitz became the most likely American response to a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. The new strategy was strongly opposed by George Kennan and others at the State Department, who raised questions about its aftermath. The negative psychosocial results of such an atomic attack might endanger post-war peace for 100 years, one official warned. But the fiercest opposition to Half Moon and the similar war plans that followed it, Fleetwood, Double Star, Trojan, and Off Tackle, came from officers in the U.S. Navy. They argued that slow-moving American bombers would be shot down before reaching Soviet cities. They said that American air bases overseas were vulnerable to Soviet attack. And most important, they were appalled by the idea of using nuclear weapons against civilian targets. The Navy had practical as well as ethical reasons for opposing the new war plans. Atomic bombs were still too heavy to be carried by planes launched from the Navy's aircraft carriers, a fact that gave the newly independent U.S. Air Force the top priority in defense spending. For more than a century, naval officers had regarded themselves as the elite of the armed services. They now resented the aggressive public relations efforts of the Air Force, the disparaging remarks about sea power, the books and articles claiming that long-range bombers had won the Second World War, the propaganda films like Walt Disney's Victory Through Air Power, with its jolly animated sequences of cities in flames and its tagline, "There's a thrill in the air." The Navy thought the atomic blitz was the wrong way to defend the free world, and at the Pentagon a battle soon raged over how the next war in Europe should be fought. Hoping to resolve the dispute, James Forrestal, who'd become Secretary of Defense, appointed an Air Force officer, General Hubert R. Harmon, to lead a study of whether a nuclear strike would defeat the Soviet Union. In May 1949, the Harmon Committee concluded that the most recent American war plan, Trojan, would reduce Soviet industrial production by 30-40%. It would also kill perhaps 2.7 million civilians and injure an additional 4 million. Those were conservative estimates, not taking into account the fires ignited by more than 100 atomic bombs. But Trojan wouldn't prevent the Red Army from conquering Europe and the Middle East. Nor would it lead to the collapse of the Soviet Union. For the majority of Soviet people, the committee noted, atomic bombing would validate Soviet propaganda against foreign powers, stimulate resentment against the United States, unify these people, and increase their will to fight. Nevertheless, Harmon saw no realistic alternative to the current war plan. The atomic blitz was the only means of rapidly inflicting shock and serious damage on the Soviet military effort, and the advantages of its early use would be transcending. On August 29, 1949, the Soviets detonated their first atomic device, RDS-1, at a test range in eastern Kazakhstan. The yield was about 20 kilotons, roughly the same as that of the bomb dropped on Nagasaki, and for good reason. RDS-1 was a copy of the Mark III implosion bomb. While American policymakers worried and fretted and debated whether to share classified atomic information with the Soviet Union, a network of communist spies infiltrated Manhattan Project laboratories and simply took it. Soviet physicists like Yuli Borisovich Kariton were brilliant and inventive, but their task was made easier by the technical knowledge gained through espionage at Los Alamos, Hanford, and Oak Ridge. The United States also provided the Soviet Union with the means for delivering an atomic bomb. In 1944, three American B-29 bombers were forced to make emergency landings in Siberia after attacking Japanese forces in Manchuria. The planes were confiscated by the Soviets, and one of them, the General H.H. Arnold Special, was carefully disassembled. Each of its roughly 105,000 parts was measured, photographed, and reverse-engineered. Within 2 years, the Soviet Union had its first long-range bomber, the Tupolev 4. The plane was almost identical to the captured B-29. It even had a metal patch where the General Arnold had been repaired. News of the Soviet bomb arrived at an unfortunate moment. General Groves had assured the American people that the Soviet Union wouldn't develop an atomic bomb until the late 1960s. The United States had just signed the North Atlantic Treaty, promising to defend Western Europe, and America's nuclear monopoly was the basis for that promise. China was on the verge of falling to Mao Zedong's communist army, and now, for the first time since the War of 1812, a devastating attack on the continental United States seemed possible. The rapid demobilization after the Second World War had, for more than a year, left North America without a single military radar to search for enemy planes. As late as 1949, the U.S. Air Defense Command had only 23 radars to guard the northeastern United States, and they were largely obsolete units that couldn't detect Soviet bombers flying at low altitudes. In the event of war, the safety of American cities would depend on the Air Force's Ground Observer Corps, thousands of civilian volunteers who would search the sky with binoculars. The news of the Soviet bomb was made all the more ominous by a sense of disarray at the Pentagon. Overwhelmed by stress, lack of sleep, and fears of international communism, Secretary of Defense Forrestal had recently suffered a nervous breakdown and leaped to his death from a 16th-floor window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. When the new Secretary of Defense, Lewis A. Johnson, canceled plans to build the United States, an enormous aircraft carrier, angry naval officers spread rumors that the Air Force's new long-range bomber, the B-36, was deeply flawed. What began as an inter-service rivalry over military spending soon became a bitter public dispute about America's nuclear strategy, with top-secret war plans being leaked to newspapers and war heroes questioning one another's patriotism. At congressional hearings in October 1949, one high-ranking admiral after another condemned the atomic blitz, arguing that the bombing of Soviet cities would be not only futile but immoral. They advocated precision tactical bombing of Soviet troops and supply lines, using planes from American aircraft carriers. Admiral William F. Halsey compared the Air Force's new bomber to the siege weapons once used to destroy medieval castles and towns. "I don't believe in mass killings of non-combatants," Admiral Arthur W. Radford testified. "A war of annihilation might bring a Pyrrhic military victory, but it would be politically and economically senseless." The harshest criticism of the Air Force came from Rear Admiral Ralph A. Ofsty, who'd toured the burned-out cities of Japan after the war. He described the atomic blitz as random mass slaughter of men, women, and children. The whole idea was ruthless and barbaric and contrary to American values. "We must ensure that our military techniques do not strip us of self-respect," Ofsty said. The Navy's opposition to strategic bombing, soon known as the Revolt of the Admirals, infuriated the Truman administration. A conventional defense of Europe seemed impossible. Congress had failed to renew the draft, defense spending was being cut, and even the Army, lacking sufficient manpower, supported the Air Force's bombing plans. The Navy's moral arguments were undercut by the main justification for building a supercarrier like the United States. It would be large enough to launch planes carrying atomic bombs. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Omar Bradley, finally ended the revolt with a dramatic appearance before Congress. Bradley had earned enormous respect during the Second World War for his soft-spoken, humane leadership of the Army, and his reputation for fairness made his testimony all the more powerful. Bradley accused the Navy of being in open rebellion against the civilian leadership of the United States. The admirals were fancy dons and aspiring martyrs who just didn't like to take orders. As for the accusation that targeting cities was immoral, Bradley responded, "As far as I am concerned, war itself is immoral." Although the Air Force and the Navy were willing to fight an ugly bureaucratic war over how atomic bombs should be used, the two services were in complete agreement about who should control them. David E. Lilienthal, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, faced unrelenting pressure from his first day in office to hand over America's nuclear arsenal to the military. The Joint Chiefs of Staff repeatedly asserted that the nation's most powerful weapons should be kept securely in the custody of officers who might one day have to use them. At the height of the Berlin crisis, Secretary of Defense Forrestal asked President Truman to transfer the entire atomic stockpile to the Air Force, warning that a Soviet attack on AEC storage facilities could leave the United States defenseless. James Webb, one of Truman's advisors, wasn't persuaded by that argument and told Lilienthal, "The idea of turning over custody of atomic bombs to these competing, jealous, insubordinate services fighting for position with each other is a terrible prospect." The president denied the military's request and publicly reaffirmed his support for civilian control of the atomic bomb. Privately, Truman explained that he didn't want to have some dashing lieutenant colonel decide when would be the proper time to drop one. White House approval of the atomic blitz gave the Strategic Air Command a role of singular importance. SAC had the only planes that could drop atomic bombs. Destruction is just around the corner for any future aggressor against the United States, an Air Force press release warned. Quick retaliation will be our answer in the form of an aerial knockout delivered by the Strategic Air Command. A wide gulf existed, however, between the rhetoric and reality. Demobilization had left SAC a hollow force, with a shortage of skilled pilots and mechanics. During one major exercise in 1948, almost half of SAC's B-29s failed to get off the ground and reach their targets. The public controversy surrounding the atomic blitz obscured a crucial point. The United States couldn't launch one. The nation's emergency war plans called for a counterattack against the Soviet Union with more than 100 atomic bombs. But SAC had just 26 flight crews available to deliver them. Perhaps half of these crews would be shot down trying to reach their targets, while others would have to ditch their planes after running out of fuel. Although SAC's retaliation might still be devastating, it wouldn't be quick. An estimated 35 to 45 days of preparation would be necessary before an all-out nuclear attack could be launched. The problems at the Strategic Air Command extended from its enlisted personnel to its leading officers. General George Kenney, the head of SAC, had little prior experience with bombers, and his deputy commander hadn't served in a combat unit since the late 1920s. During the spring of 1948, as tensions with the Soviets increased, Charles A. Lindbergh was asked to provide a secret evaluation of SAC's readiness for war. Lindbergh found that morale was low, landings were rough, training was poor, equipment was badly maintained, and accidents were frequent. A month after Lindbergh's findings were submitted, General Kenney was relieved of command. Kenney's replacement, General Curtis E. LeMay, was a bold, innovative officer who'd revolutionized bombing practices in both the European and Pacific campaigns of the Second World War. Admired, feared, honored as a war hero, considered a great patriot by his supporters and a mass murderer by his critics, LeMay soon transformed the Strategic Air Command into a model of lethal efficiency. He created a vast organization dedicated solely to nuclear combat and gave it a capacity for destruction unmatched in the history of warfare. The personality and toughness and worldview of Curtis LeMay not only molded an entirely new institutional culture at SAC, but also influenced American nuclear operations in ways that endure to the present day. And his nickname was Iron Ass for good reason. Curtis LeMay was born in 1906 and raised mainly in Columbus, Ohio. His father was a laborer who held and then lost a long series of jobs, constantly moving the family to new neighborhoods in Ohio, to Montana, California, and Pennsylvania. His mother sometimes worked as a domestic servant. Again and again, he was the new kid in school, shy, awkward, bullied. To counter the unsettled, anarchic quality of his family life, LeMay learned self-discipline and worked hard. At the age of 9, he got his first paying job, shooting sparrows for a nickel each to feed a neighbor's cat. He delivered newspapers and telegrams, excelled at academics, but felt, in his own words, cut off from normal life, earning and saving money while other kids played sports and made friends. He graduated from high school without ever having been to a dance. He'd saved enough, however, to make the first tuition payment at Ohio State University. For the next 4 years, LeMay attended college during the day, then worked at a steel mill from early evening until 2 or 3 in the morning, went home, slept for a few hours, and returned to campus for his 9 o'clock class. After studying to become a civil engineer, LeMay joined the Army Air Corps in 1929. Flying became his favorite thing to do, followed, in order of preference, by hunting, driving sports cars, and fishing. Socializing was far down the list. While other officers yearned to become fighter pilots, like the air aces of the First World War, LeMay thought that long-range bombers would prove decisive in the future. He learned to fly them, became one of the nation's finest navigators, and showed that planes could find and destroy battleships at sea. When LeMay led a bomber group from the United States to England in 1942, he was the only pilot among them who'd ever flown across an ocean. Within days of arriving in Great Britain, LeMay began to question the tactics being used in daylight bombing runs against the Nazis. American B-17s zigzagged to avoid the heavy anti-aircraft fire. The conventional wisdom held that if you flew straight and level for more than 10 seconds, you'd be shot down. But the evasive maneuvers caused bombs to miss their targets. After some late-night calculations about speed, distance, and rate of fire, LeMay came up with a radically new approach. Planes flying straight went much faster than planes that zigzagged, he realized, and therefore would spend less time exposed to enemy fire. He devised a combat box, a flight formation for 18 to 21 bombers that optimized their ability to drop bombs and defend against enemy fighters. When his men questioned the idea of heading straight into anti-aircraft fire, LeMay told them that he'd fly the lead plane, the one most likely to be shot down. On November 23, 1942, during the final approach to railway yards and submarine pens in Saint-Nazaire, France, the B-17s of LeMay's bombardment group flew straight and level for a full 7 minutes. None was shot down by anti-aircraft fire. Bombing accuracy was greatly improved. And within weeks, the tactics that LeMay had adopted for his first combat mission became the standard operating procedure for every American bomber crew in Europe. LeMay's greatest strength as a commander wasn't a subtle grasp of the historical, political, or psychological aspects of an enemy. It was his focus on the interplay between men and machines, a vision of war designed by an engineer. He also cared deeply about the safety and morale of his men. Strategic bombing required a particular form of courage. Unlike fighter pilots who flew alone, free to roam the skies in pursuit of targets, bomber crews had to work closely with one another, follow a designated route, and stay in formation. The 7 minutes from the initial aiming point to the target could induce feelings of helplessness and sheer terror as flak exploded around the plane and enemy fighters tried to shoot it down. The death rate among American bomber crews was extraordinarily high. More than half would be killed in action before completing their tour of duty. Curtis LeMay was hardly warm and cuddly. He was gruff, blunt, sarcastic, socially awkward, a man of few words, with a permanent frown left by a case of Bell's palsy and an unlit cigar perpetually stuck in his mouth. But he earned the deep loyalty of his men by refusing to tolerate incompetence and by doing everything possible to keep them alive. Instead of asking for bravery, he displayed it, flying the lead plane on some of the most dangerous missions of the war, like an old-fashioned cavalry officer leading the charge. At the age of 36, LeMay became the youngest general in the Army. During the summer of 1944, he was transferred from Europe to help fight Japan. Although incendiaries had been used on a small scale, it was LeMay who ordered the firebombing of Tokyo. "Japan would burn if we could get fire on it," one of his deputies explained. LeMay was involved in almost every detail of the plan, from selecting the mix of bombs, magnesium for high temperatures, napalm for splatter, to choosing a bomb pattern that could start a firestorm. He hoped that the firebombing would break the will of the Japanese people, avoid an American invasion, end the war quickly, and save American lives. The massive civilian casualties were unfortunate, LeMay thought, but prolonging the war would cause even more. The destruction of Japanese cities, one after another, fit perfectly with his philosophy on the use of military force. "I'll tell you what war is about," LeMay once said. "You've got to kill people, and when you kill enough of them, they stop fighting." LeMay's managerial and logistical skills made him an ideal candidate to head the Strategic Air Command. His most recent assignment had been to organize the Berlin airlift, but he also knew a lot about the atomic bomb. He'd been involved with the preparations to drop Little Boy and Fat Man, later served as a military advisor to the Manhattan Project, supervised the aircraft during the atomic test at the Bikini Atoll, and as Deputy Chief of Staff for Research and Development at the Air Force, helped to formulate the atomic blitz. LeMay recognized the destructive power of nuclear weapons, but didn't feel the least bit intimidated by them. "We scorched and boiled and baked to death more people in Tokyo," he later recalled, "than went up in vapor at Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined." And he didn't lose any sleep over the morality of Truman's decision. Killing was killing, whether you did it with a rock, a rifle, or an atom bomb. LeMay's appointment to run SAC sent a clear message to the Soviets. If necessary, the United States would not hesitate to fight a nuclear war. After arriving at SAC headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska, during the fall of 1948, LeMay was angered by what he found. Bomber crews had no idea what their targets would be if war came. Navigators lacked up-to-date maps, and pilots rarely consulted checklists before takeoff. As an exercise, LeMay ordered every SAC crew in the country to stage a mock attack on Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, at night, from high altitude, under heavy cloud cover, conditions similar to those they might encounter over the Soviet Union. Many of the planes didn't get anywhere near Ohio, and not a single one hit the target. The bombardiers who did simulate the dropping of an atomic bomb, aiming their radar at reflectors on the ground, missed Wright Field by an average of 2 miles. LeMay called it about the darkest night in American military aviation history. The top officers at SAC were let go, and LeMay replaced them with veterans of his bombing campaigns in Germany and Japan. He hoped to create a similar esprit de corps. Promotions weren't given to individuals, but to an entire crew, sometimes on the spot. And when one person screwed up, the rest of the crew also paid the price. Officers lost their jobs because of accidents and honest mistakes. I can't afford to differentiate between the incompetent and the unfortunate, LeMay explained. Standardization became the watchword at SAC, repeated like a mantra and ruthlessly pursued, with manuals and checklists and numeric measures of success created for every job. Team players were rewarded, iconoclasts and prima donnas encouraged to go elsewhere. LeMay wanted SAC to function as smoothly as the intricate machinery of a modern bomber. Every man a coupling or a tube, every organization a rampart of transistors, battery of condensers, he wrote in his memoir. All rubbed up, no corrosion, alert. Within hours of the Japanese surrender, LeMay had flown low over cities that his planes destroyed. The experience confirmed his belief that America needed an Air Force so overwhelmingly powerful that no enemy would ever dare to launch a surprise attack. After Pearl Harbor, it had taken years for the United States to mobilize fully for war. Nuclear weapons eliminated that option. If a counterattack couldn't be swift, it might never occur. LeMay wanted everyone at SAC to feel a strong sense of urgency, to be ready for war not next week or tomorrow, but at any moment, to feel we are at war now. His goal was to build a strategic air command that could strike the Soviet Union with planes based in the United States and deliver every nuclear weapon at once. SAC bomber crews constantly trained and prepared for that all-out assault. They staged mock attacks on every city in the United States with a population larger than 25,000, practicing to drop atomic bombs on urban targets in the middle of the night. San Francisco was bombed more than 600 times within a month. One of LeMay's greatest concerns was the command and control of nuclear weapons, the system of rules and procedures that guided his men, the network of radars and sensors and communications lines that allowed information to travel back and forth between headquarters and the field, the mechanisms that prevented accidental detonations and permitted deliberate ones, all of it designed to make sure that orders could be properly given, received, and carried out. To retaliate against a surprise attack, you needed to know that one had been launched. You needed to share that news with your own forces and ensure they could immediately respond. Command and control had always been a crucial element in warfare. But in a nuclear war, where decisions might have to be made within minutes and weapons could destroy cities in an instant, the reliability of these administrative systems could be the difference between victory and annihilation. A breakdown in command and control could make it impossible to launch a nuclear attack, or could order one by mistake. LeMay thought that the Strategic Air Command should control all of America's atomic bombs and select their targets. Such an arrangement would simplify things, creating a unified chain of command. It would give oversight and accountability to one military organization, his. The atomic arsenal should be viewed, according to SAC doctrine, as a single instrument, directed, controlled, if need be, from a single source. The Army, the Navy, and other units in the Air Force didn't like that idea. As LeMay worked hard to gain control of America's nuclear weapons, his rivals at the Pentagon fought to get their own, expand their influence, and limit the power of the Strategic Air Command. Lewis Slotin was tickling the dragon in a laboratory at Los Alamos, carefully lowering a beryllium shell over the plutonium core of a Mark III implosion bomb. The beryllium served as a tamper. It reflected neutrons, increased the number of fissions, and brought the assembly closer to a chain reaction. The clicks of a Geiger counter gave an audible measure of how fast the fissions were multiplying. Slotin knew what he was doing. He'd assembled the core for the Trinity test and performed dozens of criticality experiments like this one. A co-worker had asked to see how it was done, and on the spur of the moment, Slotin decided to show him. The core looked like an enormous gray pearl resting inside a shiny beryllium shell. Slotin used a screwdriver to lower the top half of that shell, and then, at about 3:20 in the afternoon on May 21, 1946, the screwdriver slipped, the shell shut, the core went supercritical, and a blue flash filled the room. Slotin immediately threw the top half of the tamper onto the floor, halting the chain reaction. But it was too late. He'd absorbed a lethal dose of radiation, and he, more than anyone else in the room, knew it. Within hours, Slotin was vomiting. His hands were turning red and swollen, his fingernails blue. General Groves flew Slotin's parents down from Winnipeg on a military plane to say goodbye. A week later, Slotin was gone, and his death was excruciating, like so many tens of thousands at Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been. It was recorded on film, with his consent, as a sobering lesson on the importance of nuclear safety. Three of the other seven men in the lab that day eventually died of radiation-induced illnesses. But Slotin had added years to their lives by thinking quickly and stopping the chain reaction. In the absence of any fast-acting safety mechanism at the laboratory, a report on the accident later concluded, Slotin was that safety device. The same plutonium core that took Slotin's life had already killed one of his assistants, Harry Daglian. A small tungsten brick had slipped from Daglian's hand while he, alone in the laboratory at night, was performing an experiment the previous August. The brick landed near the core, which became supercritical for a moment, and Daglian was dead within a month. Having taken the lives of two promising young physicists, it was nicknamed the Demon Core, placed in a Mark III bomb, and detonated during a test at the Bikini Atoll. Slotin's mishap was the fourth criticality accident at Los Alamos within a year, raising concern about the management practices at America's nuclear weapon facilities. The reactors at Hanford were not only dangerous but largely incapable of making plutonium. Most of the famous scientists who'd worked on the Manhattan Project had left government service after the war. The manufacture of atomic bombs didn't seem to be a wise career choice at a time when the world appeared ready to ban them. In April 1947, David Lilienthal visited Los Alamos for the first time after becoming head of the Atomic Energy Commission. He was shocked by what he saw. Rudimentary equipment, dilapidated buildings, poor housing, muddy, unpaved roads, and plutonium cores stored in cages at an old ice house. Lilienthal was a liberal, one of the last New Dealers in the Truman administration, and he'd seen a lot of rural poverty while running the Tennessee Valley Authority during the Great Depression. But that first day at Los Alamos, he later noted, was one of the saddest days of my life. Nuclear weapons were now thought indispensable for the defense of the United States. Lilienthal had expected to find them neatly and safely stored for immediate use. The substantial stockpile of atom bombs we and the top military assumed was there in readiness did not exist, Lilienthal subsequently wrote. Furthermore, the production facilities that might enable us to produce quantities of atomic weapons likewise did not exist. The number of atomic bombs in the American arsenal was considered so secret that it could not be shared with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or even recorded on paper. After visiting Los Alamos, Lilienthal met with President Truman in the Oval Office and told him how many atomic bombs would be available in the event of a war with the Soviet Union. At most, one. The bomb was unassembled, but, in Lilienthal's view, probably operable. The president was stunned. He'd just announced the Truman Doctrine before Congress, vowing to contain the worldwide spread of communism. Admirals and generals were fighting over the atomic stockpile, completely unaware that there wasn't one. We not only didn't have a pile, Lilienthal recalled, we didn't have a stock. The threat to destroy the Soviet Union, if it invaded Western Europe, was a bluff. During his visit to New Mexico, Lilienthal also discovered a shortage of scientists trained to make atomic bombs. The physicists, chemists, and engineers who'd put together the bombs at the end of the Second World War were now scattered throughout the United States. The Mark III implosion bomb was, in Oppenheimer's words, a haywire contraption, difficult and dangerous to assemble. But at least some of the scientists in Los Alamos still knew how to make one. Nobody had bothered to save all the technical drawings necessary for building another little boy, the uranium-based gun-type bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The exact configuration of the various parts had never been recorded on paper, an oversight that, amid the current shortage of plutonium, created some unease. As files and storerooms at Los Alamos were searched for information about Little Boy's design, a machinist offered to demonstrate how one of the bomb's aluminum tubes had been forged. He'd wrapped the metal around a Coke bottle. After the war, the Z Division at Los Alamos, which had designed the firing and fusing mechanisms of both atomic bombs, was moved an hour and a half south to an old Army air base near Albuquerque. The Z Division's headquarters was soon renamed the Sandia Laboratory, and a new military outfit called the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, AFSWP, was located at the base too. When the production of Mark III bombs resumed, the work was now divided among three organizations. Los Alamos fabricated the cores and the explosive lenses. Sandia was responsible for the rest of the weapon, and the AFSWP trained military personnel how to complete the assembly in the field. Norris Bradbury, the director of Los Alamos, pushed for improved designs that would make atomic bombs simpler, smaller, lighter, and safer to handle. It would take years for such improvements to be made. Until then, the safety of America's nuclear weapons depended on checklists, standard operating procedures, and a laboratory culture with a low tolerance for mistakes. Bradbury worried about what would happen if a B-29 bomber crashed in the United States while carrying a fully assembled Mark III bomb. The B-29 had a high accident rate. Two had crashed